This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Remember the story of Romans becoming stupider due to lead in their plates and goblets? Mercury poisoning not only kills tens of thousands of people a year, it drifts to the farthest corners, even the poles, and reduces IQ, just like lead. Scientist Ari Feinberg from the Spanish National Research Council explains the travels of this heavy metal in the stratosphere. On January 10th, five major institutes reported 2024 was definitely the hottest year ever recorded. We just smashed through major milestones in climate change. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith and I thrashed through the latest greenhouse news. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. There is news about toxic mercury in the atmosphere and how it travels to the far wilderness and even the poles. High doses of mercury in food cause severe damage to the nervous system. A 2021 study on global health effects of future atmospheric mercury emissions predicts 29,000 deaths a year from mercury poisoning by 2050. Worse, mercury reaching the womb leads to loss of IQ points for masses of babies. We need to know how this works. Dr. Ari Feinberg is a postdoctoral fellow with the Atmospheric Chemistry and Climate Group at the Spanish National Research Council. Years ago, Feinberg began his investigations into the travels and operations of mercury. Following a stint at MIT and degrees from ETH Zurich, Ari now works with Professor Alfonso Saez Lopez, the lead author of their new paper. From Madrid, Ari Feinberg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So mercury is a silvery liquid at room temperature. It is useful and it is toxic. How did your fascination with this element begin?
Well, for me, I think it's quite a unique element, as you said, being a liquid metal at room temperature and as well being so volatile. So my fascination with mercury actually started as an undergrad student where I was working with it in a lab, and this is quite difficult because it's very volatile. You always have to work in the fume hood, and as well, it sticks to everything. So it sticks to tubing lines, and this can be quite difficult for experiments. So that kind of inspired me to leave the lab and work more on the theoretical side, modeling the global cycle of this element.
And mercury is a heavy metal, and it is quite heavy. How does a metal manage to float around in the upper atmosphere?
So mercury is quite volatile, which means that it's easily emitted from surfaces. And once it's in the air, the main form of mercury, we call it elemental mercury, that actually is quite long-lived in the atmosphere. So the oxidation time is somewhere around 6 months. And until it gets oxidized, it can travel quite far distances within that 6 months. And so it can reach to even remote regions, to the polar regions, and it also can go all the way up to the stratosphere, which is what we looked at in this study.
Yeah, one of the strongest sources of things going into the stratosphere, it takes a lot to get particles up there, like volcanoes or nuclear explosions. Well, maybe we should get back to basics. Talk to us about the overall cycle of mercury, how it works from the ground to the air to the waterways and back again.
Mercury is emitted by several different types of sources. So first you have anthropogenic sources like coal combustion, also artisanal gold mining is a dominant source of mercury. So that's where they use mercury to extract gold from sediments. And later they burn this off, and so that releases mercury into the atmosphere. Another source of mercury is natural, so that's from volcanoes and other geogenic sources, but this is quite small. This is only maybe 5%. Once in the atmosphere, this mercury can travel around. It can be oxidized, which means it can react into forms that are more soluble and eventually be rained out back to the ocean or to land surfaces. And the interesting thing there is that once this is back on the surface, it doesn't stay there. So it's quite a tricky element. Due to its volatility, it can be revolatilized back into the atmosphere from oceans and land. So a lot of the emissions of mercury that we currently have, actually around 60%, these are recycling emissions from land and ocean. And so they're somewhere in between natural and anthropogenic. They're historically mainly anthropogenic mercury, but that continue recycling through natural systems.
And your new paper with Dr. Said Lopez is titled Role of the Stratosphere in the Global Mercury Cycle. Now, all along, scientists presumed airborne forms of mercury were transported by winds and weather in the troposphere lower down. Your research found mercury farther up in the stratosphere, and it is chemically active up there. Things are changing. How can non-scientists picture the way mercury transforms way up there and why it matters?
So to get up into the stratosphere, you either have to be long-lived, which is the case for mercury, or you have to be propelled up there, like what you said before, in a big volcanic eruption. And so for the case of mercury, having this lifetime of 6 months, that's enough for a significant portion of mercury to get up into the stratosphere, which is the layer that's about 12 kilometers above the ground and going up until 50 kilometers above the ground. And so the chemistry that happens there is actually quite unique. And mercury there can react in a number of different ways, but these tend to form a species of mercury, mercury chloride, which is very resistant to breaking apart by light or other reactions in the atmosphere. And so this species, the stratosphere acts as kind of a chemical factory, which is transforming mercury into a longer-lived oxidized species that can then be transported around and eventually deposited back at the Earth's surface.
And does it land in particular spots? I mean, we know there are mercury hot spots of origins, and you show them on maps in your paper, hot spots in India and China with some elevated places, maybe in the Mediterranean and South America. But how is it getting distributed, and does it fall back right near where it came from, or is it getting as far as our natural parks and all the wilderness that we think is untouched?
Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect with the stratosphere, is that the transport pathways in the stratosphere, things tend to get into the stratosphere through the tropics, and then they tend to leave either farther north or farther south in what we call the mid-latitude. So thinking about between, let's say, 40 and 60 degrees, either north or south. And so here you can have transport of mercury going even towards the poles in these remote regions coming out of the stratosphere there. So mercury, even though it's emitted mainly in industrial regions, we find mercury in ecosystems all around the world, you know, even going to the Antarctic and the Arctic. And this can be quite dangerous, actually, for communities that live within the Arctic, because they eat fish, which are affected by this mercury pollution.
So if humans had not mined mercury, I think some of the old mines were in Alameda, Spain, and places like that. We put them into thermometers. We put them into all sorts of instruments, all sorts of uses. If we had not dug them up, would there be less mercury cycling around in the atmosphere and the land and the waters?
Definitely. So there's been a lot of research into this, and the latest kind of best estimates are that humans have increased the amount of mercury in the atmosphere by about 5 times natural levels. And in the ocean, in the surface ocean, this is around 2.5 to 3 times natural levels. So we're talking about, you know, up to 3 times more mercury in the surface ocean than should be there in a natural case. And so we've had a huge perturbation on this elemental cycle going back, you know, even thousands of years is when humans started being fascinated by this element and taking advantage of some of its chemical properties. But this has definitely had consequences even until today.
And is mercury deposition from the atmosphere a significant public health threat?
Yeah, so because mercury is volatile, the atmosphere is one of the main transport pathways that brings mercury from emission sources in more industrial areas to, you know, remote areas. So mercury has, you know, consistently been listed as one of the top 10 chemical threats by different international and national environmental agencies. Yeah, one of the issues is that if we continue to emit mercury, the problem only becomes worse. So mercury is a chemical element. It's, you know, it doesn't get destroyed as an element. The only permanent loss is when it's buried in marine sediments after a thousand years or so. So we continue to suffer from pollution in the historical past. And so that's why it's critical for us to cut emissions of mercury in order that this contamination doesn't continue building up in the future and further endangering seafood safety.
And we know mercury is harmful to animals, but I think you did an earlier study on mercury and plants. So what did you find there?
Mercury is taken up by forests. This is actually one of the main loss pathways of mercury from the atmosphere. Around a third of mercury in the atmosphere is taken up on land by forests. And so for the plants, there's not a ton of information about how harmful this could be. But through the plants, mercury can get into soils and into also terrestrial ecosystems. So there's been some studies done looking at how insects in terrestrial environments and also the predators in the terrestrial food chain, like birds, they can have high levels of mercury, which might as well affect their physiology.
So if forests are sort of capturing mercury, I presume there must be a fair amount of mercury in wildfire smoke.
Yes, that's also an important terrestrial source of mercury. So these forests take up mercury, but as we see, like, that storage of mercury is temporary. And if these forests are disturbed through wildfires, the mercury can get back into the atmosphere and enter again into the cycle.
And adding to the whole cycle, humans continue to mine more mercury and emit more into the air from, as you say, coal-burning power plants and crude gold mining as another source. I thought there was a United Nations Convention to reduce dangerous mercury. What was the intent there, and where does that stand?
Yeah, so there's been a UN convention, the Minamata Convention on Mercury, which entered into force in 2017. So this is a very new convention. They have a number of policies which are aimed at addressing mercury pollution. And so one of them is the goal to stop mercury mining. Another one is that countries, parties to the Minamata Convention, should apply the best available technology to try and reduce emissions of mercury from coal power plants and other industrial sources. Another part of the convention is that countries that do have gold mining going on in their territory, that they take measures to try and address this. And so this convention is still quite new, but there are some positive results coming out of all of these global policy efforts. In another study, which I published last year, we looked at the trends of mercury in the atmosphere, in the Northern Hemisphere, and we could actually see that the amount of mercury has been declining in the atmosphere over the last 15 years. And so this is showing that what countries have been doing to try and tackle this pollution issue, that might be working.
It's interesting you mentioned the Northern Hemisphere. Since 2020, about 88% of mercury production came from China, with Tajikistan, Russia, and Mexico amongst the principal miners. And all of this, and most of the industrial consumption, is in the Northern Hemisphere. Are mercury emissions staying in the global north?
The majority of global emissions are in the global north. In the global south, the major emission source is from artisanal and small-scale gold mining. And so this is an important source in Latin America and as well in many parts of Africa and as well, say, Southeast Asia. And so that's the main emission source of mercury from those regions.
And will ongoing climate change affect the mercury cycle, including airborne aerosols of this heavy metal?
Yes, so there's a number of ways that climate change could affect the mercury cycle, going from what we looked at in our study, which was how in the future the transport of mercury into the stratosphere will become faster. And so this could affect how mercury becomes distributed within the atmosphere. But that's just, you know, one aspect that could change in the future. Other studies have looked into how food chains will change in the future, which could affect how mercury bioaccumulates in the environment. Other studies looking at, you know, how, let's say, forest growth will affect uptake of mercury onto land. And so here there's a lot of unknowns, and I think it's important to continue to research the many different global change processes that might affect mercury pollution.
Do we have enough mercury-free alternative technology so we could stop digging up more and spreading it everywhere?
That's a great question. So there are, for some processes, there are good mercury alternatives. I think one of the most challenging is the gold mining issue, where there are many NGOs and other organizations looking to introduce gold mining techniques that don't involve mercury, but this is still an area of active efforts.
And is the mercury in the stratosphere, is the role of that somewhat, is it significant or is it pretty small compared to what's traveling around in the troposphere? How would you answer that one?
So what we found in our study is that, you know, depending on what level you take for the stratosphere, around, you know, between 5 to 50% of the mercury passes through the stratosphere. So quite a big fraction of the mercury is traveling through the stratosphere. Another aspect that we looked into is how important the stratosphere is for the transport of mercury from one hemisphere to another. So from the northern hemisphere, where most of the emissions are happening, to the south. And what we found is that it's almost half-half. So half of the mercury that's traveling from the northern hemisphere all the way to the southern hemisphere is taking the route through the stratosphere. And so this is, you know, an important transport pathway for mercury within the overall global atmosphere.
So we have listeners in Australia. Should they be worried that mercury is coming down with the rain? And also, how significant is this as a public health threat right now? I mean, should listeners be staying up late night worrying about mercury, or is this just something else we need to know about and get control of?
Both are great questions. So I would say the researchers definitely are staying up thinking about this, but I don't know if they're worried, you know, in the day-to-day with all the other aspects that we have in our lives. But I would say that mercury, as a health threat, I think it's a big concern for me, at least for the future. You know, if we continue to emit, the risks in seafood will get worse and worse. But on the other hand, there are promising signs in terms of 151 countries coming together in this UN convention to tackle mercury pollution. I think that's a great example of how countries could collaborate on this issue. And as well, I mean, with seafood, thinking about seafood, which is our main intake of mercury, we also have to be cautious about saying that, you know, listeners shouldn't eat seafood, because seafood also has a lot of great nutrients. It's an important part of a lot of people's diet. And there has been some research that actually the benefits or the beneficial nutrients in seafood outweigh the drawbacks from having higher mercury. For me, it's more of a concern that as we continue to emit mercury, that balance might change as you know, we're adding these contaminants into the ocean. We shouldn't be alarmist about the mercury issue and have it stop us from continuing including fish in our diet. On the other hand, we should follow the national advisories about how much fish different groups should have each week or each month. And we should try to make choices that reduce the amount of mercury being emitted into the environment. So, for example, supporting renewable energies, you know, investigating where the gold that we're consuming is coming from, and making smart choices as an individual as well.
And your work literally added a whole new layer to what we know about mercury in the atmosphere. But what don't we know? What research needs to keep going on this?
So I think, you know, we've opened up that the stratosphere might be an important transport pathway for mercury, but there's still a lot that we need to research about how this transport through the stratosphere could affect mercury at the surface, as well as how the mercury cycle in general is going to change with climate change. One aspect is how human society will change. Are we going to reduce the emissions of mercury in the future? But another aspect is increasing temperatures. How will this affect the methylation of mercury, which is how it gets to be more toxic, and as well how general transport of mercury will change in the future?
From Madrid, we've been speaking with Dr. Ari Feinberg from the Blas Cabrera Institute of Physical Chemistry, part of the Spanish National Research Council. Find out more with my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Ari, thank you for looking up and for spending time with our listeners.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We just lived through two insanely hot years on planet Earth. Places flooded, dried right out, and burned. Carbon stored in plants went into the sky along with toxic ash when plastic cities burn. The Big Five climate tracking agencies all reported about 2024 on January the 10th. Were the past 2 years just freak time, or is it the start of rapid global heating? To discuss results in reality, we are joined by Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith. After lecturing on climate science at two universities, Paul produces YouTube video explainers for Breaking Climate Science. I use them. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
So, five reports came out from the UK Met Office, NASA, Copernicus in Europe, Berkeley Earth, and the World Meteorological Organization. Although carefully avoiding words of alarm, to me these graphs and maps seem more like reports from a war zone. What do you think, Paul?
Yes, they're certainly surprising and maybe wake-up calls to some people, hopefully, because, you know, 2024 and 2023 were literally off the charts for atmospheric temperatures, for sea surface temperatures, for, you know, ocean heat content, you know, and all the other metrics that one might look at. And they clearly show that we've left 1.5 Celsius above so-called pre-industrial in the rearview mirror, I think.
And how much hotter than pre-industrial is this planet?
Well, the pre-industrial, for all of these different groups that did the atmospheric temperatures, is pretty much 1850 to 1900, the average of that time period. And the Berkeley group came up with 1.62 degrees Celsius for 2024 above pre-industrial. And the other groups were mostly over 1.5, but they were not quite as high as 1.62. And I just also want to remind people that when the original 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius numbers were talked about in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, the pre-industrial was loosely defined as the year 1750. And if you look at the temperature difference between 1750 and the new baseline definition, 1850 to 1900, we've got about 0.15, 0.2 degrees Celsius different. So we're rapidly on our way to 2 degrees at this point, 2 degrees Celsius.
Wow. Well, the two lower global average warming estimates showing below 1.5 degrees are from American government-sponsored NASA and NOAA. Overseas, the UK Hadley Centre, Europe's Copernicus, and the World Meteorological Organization are all higher than 1.5 and close to or above that 1.6 that you mentioned of current warming. Are the Americans already lowballing global warming? We have to ask.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I find that one of the most reliable and accurate sources, prescient sources, is actually the papers that James Hansen puts out. And he's talked about exceeding 1.5 for a long period of time. So 2024 was the first calendar year, but actually each month going back to, you know, halfway through 2023 was mostly exceeding the 1.5 already. And Hansen's also attributed it to, you know, the spike upwards in the last few years to the reduction of sulfur from shipping fuels by the International Maritime Organization, which is a group within the UN, I believe. So they've really tightened the controls on sulfur in commercial shipping fuels, and as a result, there's less sulfur over the oceans and the routes that they ply, which are mostly in the northern hemisphere. And as a result, there are fewer cloud condensation nuclei, so fewer low-lying clouds, so therefore more sunlight is reaching the surface of the planet, both the land and ocean surfaces, and causing a great acceleration of heating in the last few years.
Paul, I know you studied the poles and the ice world, and you carefully watch ocean temperatures, but let's start out with the land where most of us live. According to the country breakdown at Berkeley Earth, our Canada has not warmed by 1.5 degrees C. No, we heated up twice that, to 3.1 degrees C on average in 2024. So it's no wonder Canadian forests burned beyond recognition the past 2 years. Talk about the reality of climate change in Canada.
We're seeing a lot more weather extremes in Canada. In a warmer world, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. You know, that water vapor has convective uplift and feeds more storms, larger storms that cause more disruption. So the extreme weather events in Canada have gotten so bad, actually, that Lloyd's of London in 2019 said that they weren't going to reinsure insurance companies in Canada any longer. They're one of the world's largest reinsurance companies, which insures the insurance companies. So if you're in the insurance business, then people are having a tough time with their models and with their knowledge on climate change. And they're basically saying that some regions just are going to become uninsurable. You know, if you want to talk about insurance, what about the people in the Los Angeles region in Southern California? Many insurance companies are not insuring houses in regions like that now because the risks are just too large. The extreme weather events in Canada, you know, in the last few years have skyrocketed, whether it be large hailstorms, whether it be the wildfires that burned down half the town of Jasper, you know, flooding in other regions, and, you know, other large wind events. I mean, it's just things are just accelerating very, very fast in terms of extreme weather events. It's not just in Canada. This is recognized, becoming more and more recognized around the world. I was just reading a report put out by the World Economic Forum. These are the people that hold the Davos conference each year, and this conference is coming up, and they always precede the conference with a report, and it looks at risks, global risks. It's an assessment based on feedback from CEOs of companies and scientists and, you know, a wide range of people from different academic backgrounds and industry, and they assess risks, planetary risk, over, say, the next year or two, over a time frame of 5 years out and 10 years out. And the top risks by far are climate change related risks, like extreme weather events, the risks of abrupt tipping points, and the risks to biodiversity, and things like that. Also, misinformation was high up on their list. But the climate change risks weren't top for the next year or two, according to most of the people that were surveyed. You know, but in 5 years, they're more prevalent, and in 10 years, they dominate the situation of global risk.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith joins Alex Smith with a report on climate disruption in 2024.
For our European listeners, Copernicus Science and Satellite Service says, quote, 2024 was the warmest year on record for Europe, with an average temperature of 10.69 degrees C, and that is 0.28 degrees C higher than the previous warmest year, which was 2020.